Welcome to Second Court of Appeals. I understand we have a little water leakage problem in the back, but it doesn't sound like it will distract us too badly. We only have one case on our 9 o'clock docket for argument. City of Paulton City versus Brian L. et al. And if the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today.
May it please the court, Mr. James Jeffrey, to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Billy McGill to argue for the appellant.
All right, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm Jim Jeffrey and I represent Haltom City in this case. And we're here because of a flood event that happened that caused serious injuries to the Aurel family members and the death of a young woman. And we're also here on an interlocutory appeal of the trial court's denial of the city's motion for summary judgment. The city had asserted sovereign immunity and asserted a jurisdictional defense. I think it helps where I'm going to be going with the argument to just briefly review sovereign immunity. The city is entitled to sovereign immunity or presumption of sovereign immunity unless there's a clear and unambiguous legislative waiver of the sovereign immunity. And that's set forth by statute and case law. The standard of review in this court is de novo of this type of a motion or plea. The background of this case is the trailer park where the flooding occurred was entirely private property. The mobile homes were occupied by people that were leasing them from a gentleman who's a defendant but not party to this appeal. The flood zone area or creek adjacent to the mobile home was not owned by the city. The city's nearest owned property is about a mile downstream from the mobile home park. And yet, the plaintiffs are trying to hold the city liable under a couple of theories because of the flood that occurred. And the flood was such a severe, unexpected emergency that the city was not even experiencing rain at the time of the flood. The city had a crew off in another city helping because of flooding that was happening and causing immediate risk of loss of life in the city of Keller, and so the city's swift water rescue boat and crew was over in Keller when the flood hit the mobile home park. And at the time the flood hit the mobile home park, there was already a city fire engine with Lieutenant Wagner that had gone to the mobile home park to check out to see if there was flood water hitting. Eventually, six cities came to the mobile home park with emergency crews and equipment to help. And the President of the United States eventually declared this to be an area-wide disaster, and it has all the earmarks of an emergency. And I direct the court's attention to the City of San Antonio and Hartman Supreme Court case. It has a lot of similarities involving an emergency and a declaration of a disaster. The plaintiffs who are appellees here rely on the Supreme Court case, as they describe it, for a framework of their claims, the Wilson Supreme Court case. And I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes, but the Wilson case, I think, just doesn't fit for a whole lot of reasons. And then the plaintiffs also have asserted that because the city adopted a flood prevention and control ordinance, which the state of Texas requires all cities and counties to adopt, pursuant to the federal flood insurance program, the plaintiffs are asserting that the city had assumed duties or somehow control over this private property. I would submit on behalf of the city that if duties can arise under this type of ordinance, which is required by the state and which doesn't have any specific mandates in it as to how the city should perform flood control measures, then potentially every city in Texas is going to be in a position where when a flood arises, unless they can somehow prevent the type of tragedy that happened here, then those cities are in effect ensuring or guaranteeing the safety of people who live on private property in flood zones.
But doesn't the potential duty to handle these emergency situations and or provide notice, doesn't it arise out of the combination of the city's ordinance with the flood plan that the city itself adopted?
Well, that's what the plaintiffs are contending, but I don't think that's a correct analysis. As a starting point, the city's asserted discretionary immunity for all of the six items, or five of the six items that the plaintiffs have pointed to. The six items that are cited and discussed in the briefing include a failing to have mobile homes in the park removed from the floodway, include a failure to implement and carry out a plan for structural improvements, and a failure to exercise reasonable care and implementation of the action plan to expand drainage maintenance. Now, on those issues, we also had summary judgment evidence that was uncontroverted that maintenance was not an issue. The plaintiffs appear to focus in their summary judgment briefing and in briefing in this court on a failure to require removal of mobile homes from private property and a failure to implement some sort of a vague notion of a corrective or emergency action plan. Those are all discretionary functions, immune legislative discretionary functions, quite similar to the kinds of functions that are talked about in the Grapevine versus Sipes case that started in this court and went to the Supreme Court. In that case, the city of Grapevine had targeted an intersection for a traffic control device, had not installed the device at the time of the collision, and was sued because it didn't have a device that it had recognized should eventually be installed. And the Supreme Court held that the decision as to when and how to implement a plan like that is a discretionary immune function. And that's what we have here. The city adopted an ordinance that had long-range goals but no specific dates or deadlines or methods or means prescribed with certainty as to when the city would carry out and how the city would carry out a lot of these aspirational goals that are set forth in the ordinance. And essentially, the city's being sued because it failed to do a number of things, according to the plaintiffs. And that's clearly within the umbrella of a discretionary, immune, and legislative immune function. And so, even though that's how the case is framed, that's an incorrect framework to use. If you look at the Wilson case, the Supreme Court also placed in that case some clear language that stated, under the facts that the plaintiffs are relying on here, we're not giving an opinion as to whether a duty can arise. And what happened in the Wilson case is one state department owned and controlled a park. Another state department owned and controlled some land adjacent to the park. The park had facilities that were often used by hikers and campers in a flood danger area. There were some signs in that park, unlike here, where the state stated, we will warn, if you hear warning sirens, evacuate immediately because it's a flood danger. One of the complaints that's made here is the city didn't have warning signs, but yet in the Wilson case, the idea was by placing those signs that even if the state department entity that was sued didn't own the place where the flooding occurred, by placing those warning signs, the plaintiffs in that case argued that that state department had assumed a duty of some sort. In this case, there were no warning signs, and so even under that scenario, the Wilson case wouldn't apply. But yet in Wilson, the Supreme Court stated, we give no opinion as to whether a duty can arise under that fact situation, nor do we state an opinion as to whether liability can be established under that situation. They just simply remanded the case. So relying on Wilson shouldn't give any help to the plaintiffs.
But isn't the Wilson case just saying, the Supreme Court is saying, we are not going to determine whether there is a duty, but there is some evidence to go forward on the duty issue, so it's a fact issue that then the prior fact has to determine.
Well, if you look at it simply like that, I think the Supreme Court is saying we're sending it back to the lower courts to address this, but In that case, the key issue was whether these warning signs had been posted, arguably created a duty, and was there a breach of that duty? Well, here we don't have that kind of a warning sign. We don't have anything like that. One of the theories is the city's being sued because it didn't have a sign like that. The fact that the city or any governmental entity that has the ability to adopt legislation might have some authority under such legislation to go at some point and take action doesn't create a duty to take the action. And it doesn't create a duty as to the specifics of how to carry out that action. So I think we have a different situation here. We have the absence of a sign, and we have a theory that the city failed to do a number of things under some sort of an ordinance. I think also, even if you look at this case as having a duty that arises, the duty that arises is a requirement to perform at the time the city knows there is a flood event. And that's quite clear. We have cited, and I think both sides have discussed, the Reyes and the Stewart cases from the Supreme Court that involved floodings on roadways that had known low water crossings. And in those cases, the Supreme Court held that when you look at a case under the Tort Claims Act and you look at the duties that the government has to carry out, the duties arise at the time of the flood event when the city or the government knows that there is a flood going on. And here, it's been conceded by the plaintiffs, both in the lower court and again in their briefing here, that the city was not negligent at the time of the flood, and it's been conceded that the city did not act with conscious indifference or reckless disregard. Now, the city's duties at the time the flood occurs, excuse me, losing my voice, the city's duties at the time the flood occurs are to have either warned or to try to make safe from the flood event. It's undisputed here that the city was responding and was not negligent in its response and did not act with conscious indifference. And when we're responding and don't act with conscious indifference, these are the duties owed to a licensee, it's undisputed that at best the plaintiffs would be considered licensees. When we're responding in that way, we've carried out the only obligation we would arguably have under the Wilson case. Well, that's what they're claiming, but that's not what the Supreme Court says. The Supreme Court says you look at our actions, the city's actions, at the time of the flood event. If we were required to take preventative measures or carry out preventative actions, that's exactly the type of immune legislative discretionary function that the city can't be sued for under the SIPES type of analysis. That would be a situation where, in effect, you would have potentially a court directing a governmental entity as to when and how to spend money to make public improvements or spend public money on private property.
But then you had a responsibility to pass this ordinance, correct?
If the city wanted its citizens to participate in the flood insurance program, yes. That's correct. Unless the ordinance specifically spelled out when, how, and the manner of carrying out any duties arguably assumed. And without that, these functions that the city is being sued for are all discretionary functions as to when to perform a purchase of private property, when to require removal of existing grandfathered structures from private property. But the ordinance doesn't mandate that. There's no state law mandating that. There's no federal law mandating that. Those are all discretionary functions that fall under the analysis the Supreme Court used in the Sipes case.
So the mandate is simply to pass an ordinance. You didn't have to do anything pursuant to the ordinance. You just had to pass it.
I don't think it's that simple. I think we had a duty to pass an ordinance that met the guidelines imposed by FEMA. FEMA's guidelines require an overall eventual plan to try to address flood-prone areas, and that's what this ordinance does. But as far as mandating when and how that's going to occur, there's no statute, no regulation, and certainly nothing in the ordinance that requires that. And if you look at this case also, it's undisputed it was an emergency event. Because the city, putting aside all these other issues, because the city was responding to an emergency event, the city can only be found to have a waiver of its sovereign immunity if the city acted with conscious indifference to the safety of these folks, or if the city violated a law or a statute or an ordinance in connection with responding. There's no allegation of a law, statute, or ordinance that applies. There's no allegation of a violation of any duty of not to act with conscious indifference. In fact, they concede that the city did not act with conscious indifference. I see I'm out of time. I'll be happy to try to address any other questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. All right, Mr. McGill.
May it please the court. My name is Billy McGill, and I'm here today representing the Collins family, and Mr. Osborne is representing the RL family. He's conceded his time to me because our issues are pretty much identical for purposes of this appeal. Government immunity is waived if there's a personal injury or death caused by a dangerous condition of real property. That's Section 101.021. The dangerous condition of real property in this case were 27 mobile homes in the Skyline Mobile Home Park sitting in a floodway. The Collins and RL homes were among those homes sitting in a floodway. The ordinance defines a floodway as an extremely hazardous area due to the velocity of floodwaters, which carry debris, potential projectiles. Fire Chief Rhodes more aptly described a floodway as creek level, so to speak. You know, there's evidence in the record there was a long history of flooding in the Skyline Park. It took place many, many years, many, many times before the incident in question happened. There was actually, because of this, there was actually a 1987 flood ordinance that the city passed that barred mobile homes from being placed in floodways. Nevertheless, in 2007, our clients' mobile homes were sitting in a floodway. And the reason for that, because the city had grandfathered those mobile homes, or mobile homes that were there before 1978, although there's nothing in the record in this case that shows that our clients' mobile homes were there pre-78 and were subject to this grandfathering situation. Now, the city takes a position. We didn't own, we didn't occupy. This is private property. We didn't own it or occupy it. But there are exceptions to that. One is the Wilson case, which we've talked about. The other is the Cameron County case versus Brown, where a city or government unit assumes control or responsibility for a premises. That was a case where there was a bridge that was owned by the state, but the county had maintenance responsibilities for the streetlights. And the court held that if you assume control over part of the maintenance, that's sufficient to impose a duty on you. The Wilson case, what the Wilson case held, and we think it's obviously a very significant case for our situation, is that a government unit does not have to own or control a premises to have a duty if it undertakes to make the premises safe or to protect others. In that case, it was the Peter Nalish River, which the Department of Parks and Wildlife did not own, did not control, but they had posted warning signs in the park and put up warning sirens, and warn people in the park that if the siren goes off, you know, depart the park because a flood's coming. And the court determined that that may have imposed, you know, it remanded the case back to the trial court so the trial court could determine whether those acts on the part of the department were sufficient to undertake a duty to protect park visitors. So the teaching of the Wilson case that's important here is that Haltom City didn't have to own the creek, didn't have to control the creek in order to be subject to a duty. Now, we think there's evidence in this case that there was control over the creek. By reading the ordinance where the legislature has delegated the responsibilities to cities to minimize flood losses for creeks within their boundaries, there's evidence that the city had undertaken channel improvements, drainage maintenance, dredging out creeks to make the drainage capacity greater, comprehensive regulation and restrictions of development in flood hazard areas. We think there's evidence under the Camden County versus Brown case that the city exercised control over the creeks within its limits sufficient to impose a duty on the a duty of care on the city towards the plaintiffs. But there's also evidence under Wilson of an extensive undertaking, much more so than the undertaking in the Wilson case, by Haltom City to protect the folks at Skyline from the flooding issue. In 1990, there was a meeting that Haltom City officials had with FEMA addressing the Skyline flooding problem. It had been a problem for many years. And FEMA's concern was that Haltom City was grandfathering these 27 mobile homes that were sitting in a floodway. FEMA asked Haltom City, well, what are we going to do about this? This is an issue. We think FEMA told Haltom City, we think you need to let these people know, at the very least, that they're living in a floodway. So as a result of that meeting, the Haltom City manager said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to enact a proactive public notification program where we're going to inform the people that are living down there that they're living in a floodplain. We're going to send out letters. We're going to make sure there's a process set forth that future residents that move into the park will be told that they're living in a floodway. And that way, we address your concern about these people living down there oblivious to the danger they're subject to. And they did that on one occasion in December of 1990. They sent out letters to Skyline residents saying, you're living in a floodway. The problem with that is that's the only time that happened. That program after that fell by the wayside. And by the time the Collinses moved in 2006 and 2007, they weren't sending out letters. There weren't any kind of notices to give them warnings that the homes that they were renting were in a floodway.
But how is a city manager's creation or adoption of an internal policy likened to an ordinance that the entire city council approves and adopts?
Well, later on in the 2002 flood ordinance, part of that involved enacting a public notification or public education program, which mirrors what the manager was talking about in 1990. So they actually put something like that in their flood mitigation action plan that was part of the ordinance in 2002. So they did actually codify that in 2002, but then they proceeded not to do anything to make sure that those folks were made aware of the fact that they're going to sleep every night in a floodway.
Would you discuss the fee the city charged for the residents under the water bill?
Yeah, the stormwater utility fee. That was part of the 2002 flood mitigation action plan that that the city passed in 2002. And one of the reasons they passed that was to address some of the significant flooding problems, one of which was the Skyline Mobile Home Park. And what the city determined to do was we need to buy out, the only long-term solution to this problem is to buy out the mobile homes down there that are in the floodway. And we're going to have to come up with some money to do that. And so they posed two funding mechanisms to come up with the money to do the buyout. One of them was to enact a stormwater utility fee, which was a fee that would be charged to residents of Haltom City of, you know, I forget how much it was. It was like $5 a month or something like that on your added to your water bill. And those funds were to be earmarked for flood mitigation activities, in which would include the buyout. You know, City Manager Muir said, yes, the buyout was part of the flood mitigation activities we're talking about. So they enacted this fee in 2004, started collecting the money in 2005. 2005 to 2006, the records show they collected about $2.5 million from that stormwater utility fee. Again, earmarked for flood mitigation, earmarked for the very thing we're here about. That money should have been used for buyouts, for channel improvements, for the very things that they plan to do in the flood mitigation action plan. But the problem with that is they ended up not spending any of that money on the Skyline buyout or anything to do with I don't know exactly what they did with it, but they surely didn't spend it on the Skyline problem. The other thing, that the other funding mechanism that they came up with in the 2002 flood mitigation action plan was the idea of applying for a grant from FEMA. FEMA gives grants to cities that come up with flood mitigation plans that meet their criteria. And once FEMA approves your plan, then you're eligible to apply for a grant from FEMA to get money. And so the other part of the funding of the buyout of the Skyline Mobile Homes was we're going to apply for a FEMA grant, and they'll match 75% of the funding. They became eligible for the grant in 2002, but then for some inexplicable reason, they didn't apply for it in 2002. It just dropped by the wayside. Never applied for the money, never got the money, and never, you know, were able to use money they could have gotten in that way to do the buyout until after the deadly flood happened. Then they applied for the FEMA grant, got it, and started buying out these properties. That's something they should have done, that they planned to do in 2002 when they passed the Flood Mitigation Action Plan. Now, the Flood Mitigation Action Plan, Mr. Jeffries talks about it being something that was a goal or an aspiration. When you read it, I mean, this is a specific action plan. They talk about no action is there's a section in the ordinance that says, you know, we've got to do something immediately. A no action alternative is unacceptable. That's language from the statute. This was an immediate problem that needed immediate action, but then they proceeded to take no action for the next 5 years leading up to the deadly flood. Now, there were some other things that the city did in addition to what's in the ordinance that constituted part of their undertaking to protect Skyline residents. They actually had a special protocol for Skyline Mobile Home Park that the fire and rescue folks would go down there every time it was raining heavy to see if it was flooding, because it flooded so often. They didn't want to wait till the water started coming up over the banks to get down there. They would go down there and monitor. They put barricades up there. They'd go door to door warning people. They actually enacted a program where the mayor could issue an evacuation order so that the fire department could go down there and force people to evacuate from Skyline. That was in response to a flood that had happened about 2 or 3 months earlier to the one that caused the deaths and injuries in this case. They had put up warning sirens, like you had in the Wilson case, that one of the things that triggered those were floods. It didn't go off on the night in question. They had a code red warning program where they could call people on the telephone and warn them about disasters. So that didn't go off on the evening in question. So under Wilson, all of these things were part of the massive undertaking that Haltom City did to protect Skyline residents. And that, under the Wilson case, was significant in our view to subject it to a duty of care owed to the plaintiffs in this case.
But they had actually put that protocol into action on the previous occasion.
They had put that protocol into action on previous occasions. But the problem with that protocol is, in the case of the night that this happened, is that by the time they were down there in the park, the water was already getting up into homes, and it was too late to warn anybody or get anybody out. And that's why it's our position that something should have been done long before the water started coming up over the banks. There should have been a warning given. They should have taken action on the buyout. If you're not going to buy them out, if you're not going to spend all the money that you've raised, at the very least, you should have warned these folks. And it could have been done as simple as putting up a $40 sign, which is what they did after the flood. They put up some $40 signs that says this area is in a floodway. That could have been done, should have been done, years before this happened. And if it had, then I think the city would probably have met the duty that it owed to the plaintiffs.
But if they had sirens and a code red method, why would you also need signs?
Well, the problem with the sirens is the testimony was they were never used for floods. The sirens didn't go off in this flood event. The code red was never used. It proved to be an inadequate way to warn people. They never used it. So if you're not going to use it, you know what good is it? And I guess our thought was these people need to know, sooner rather than later, that they're living in a floodway and they're going to sleep every night in the floodway. And the most effective way, the way we think they should have done it is either with the letter program that they had done once, or by posting signs at the entrance to the park, which actually the mobile home park did with the city's cooperation after the fact, that would have been the most effective way to warn these folks that they're living in a floodway. I don't know if my time is up. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. And I thank you for letting me speak.
All right, thank you, Mr. McGill. Mr. Jeffrey.
Yes.
The ordinance that he's referring to, where the city sets forth various things that it's going to eventually do, and it does recognize that the mobile home park here is in a flood danger area, also recognizes other flood danger areas in the city. The recognition of a danger in an ordinance without a specific requirement to do something at a certain time in a certain way still involves immune, discretionary, and legislative functions. The idea that a governmental entity can recognize a problem it would like to solve or address doesn't impose a duty on the governmental entity to address that in a particular way, unless there is a clearly defined specific requirement as to when and how to carry it out.
Well, in the Wilson case, there wasn't a specifically defined requirement to post signs, but they did so, and y'all sent out letters at one point in time.
Yeah.
So why is that not analogous?
Well, in the Wilson case, there's no claim that there was a statute or an ordinance or a piece of legislation involved. The governmental entity in Wilson actually put a sign in place, and the issue that I understood was going to be remanded, one of the fact issues, was did the sirens get used, did they fail to work, or did they fail to use or try to use the sirens? Those are all different issues than assuming a duty arising from a piece of legislation.
Well, wasn't there a fact issue in that case as well as to whether there was a duty?
Well, the duty, I think, would be arising from the sign that was posted. Here, there was no sign posted. The ordinance doesn't mandate posting of signs. It doesn't mandate specific warnings. It doesn't mandate any specific education program. The letters that were sent, and I addressed this in our reply brief at length, the letters that were sent in 1990 were sent to the known occupants of particular mobile homes, and also to the Skyline mobile home operators. And the city does not know who's in which mobile home. The city's not notified when people move in and out of a mobile home. The city doesn't even collect money from these people. They don't pay water bills to the city, which include the water bill fee that was talked about. The mobile home, this is in the summary judgment record, undisputedly, the plaintiffs all testified, we didn't pay anything to the city ever for utilities or water or sewer. The mobile home park would pay a bulk bill to the city, but not these individuals. Well, it would include the fee, but the individual. The purpose of the fee was to do a lot of things, including eventually make improvements to various drainage problems in the area. I want to say it was a stormwater fee. Governmental entities, cities, are allowed to collect fees to address stormwater issues. Well, to address, it has to be used for stormwater issues, but again, there's no requirement as to when and how to spend the money. And I think you're getting into the area of legislative immune functions when a governmental entity, whether it collects taxes, whether it collects a fee, whether it collects money of some sort, just collecting it, if it receives $1 to address something that might cost $20 million, then the city's not required to start spending money immediately just because it's collected a dollar. The city has just, over time, it was, at the time of the flood, I think it was estimated between $1.5 and $2 million had been collected. The buyout, just for informational purposes, I don't think it's relevant, but the buyout has cost the city with grant money close to $2 million, and that still has not been a completed project. What I think is important is when a city has maybe the authority or can obtain the authority through condemnation or otherwise to take action, it still doesn't impose a duty on the city as to when and how to carry that duty out. In the Sipes case, the city had identified an intersection for a traffic control device, had not installed the device at the time of the collision, and the Supreme Court said it is an immune legislative and discretionary function for the city as to when and how it's going to decide to spend its resources. And there's never been anything identified in this case mandating when and how the city would spend any money it either got by taxes, fees, or grant. That's a discretionary immune function for the city to decide upon. Looks like I'm out of time, unless you have any further questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. We appreciate your argument. Mr. McGill, we appreciate your arguments as well. Mr. Osborne, thank you for being here with us. We appreciate all of your briefing in this matter and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and if the clerk will now adjourn us, please.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District.